Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy. I'm Livonia Mallory. I'm still on my couch.
I'm Guy Schaefer, broadcasting from my kitchen table. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, first we hear part two of Corinne Carey's conversation with Assemblymember John McDonald as he discusses the distribution of the coronavirus vaccine and looks forward to the 2021 budget. Then we'll hear part two of Birth Justice Episode 8 on the Albany Birth Justice Storytelling Project. After that, Corinne Carey speaks with Naomi Edmondson, a Black queer death guide and author of the Glorious Hum blog. Then from the International Arts Showcase, HMM's Erica interviews singer and actor Keandre Harrison. And to close out the show, Livonia and I will be speaking with our indefatigable engineer and coordinator of the Hudson Mohawk magazine, Alexis Goldsmith, who makes this show possible every weekday. But first, here are the headlines.
During the attempted coup takeover attempt at the Capitol, white supremacists were seen leading the attack. One supremacist, Jake Angeli, known as the QAnon Shaman, was seen wearing a fur-lined buffalo horns and displaying his many white supremacist-laden tattoos on his bare chest. One tattoo, the three interlocking triangles, is known as the Volk Knot, or Knot of Slain. According to the ADL website, the Volk Knot is an Old Norse symbol that often represents the afterlife in carvings and design. It is often considered a symbol of the Norse god Odin. Some white supremacists, particularly racist Odinists, have appropriated the Volk Knot to use as a racist symbol. Often they use it as a sign that they are willing to give their life to Odin, generally in battle.
Global average temperatures last year were tied for the hottest on record, capping what was also the planet's hottest decade ever recorded, according to new data analysis released Friday. It was abundantly clear in 2020 that the world is already seeing worsening disasters from climate change.
The Capital Region coronavirus death toll is moving at its fastest clip yet. It looks just 15 days from the region to go from 500 to 600 deaths, with Albany County accounting for 40% of them. The Capital District is averaging 875 new cases a day, with the positivity rate for COVID tests over 10%. Local officials fear the worst is yet to come, as new infections from Christmas and New Year's related gatherings are starting to pour in. Everybody, wear your mask.
It's an act of love. The Times Union reports that Governor Cuomo's State of the State address on Monday will include proposals to combat domestic violence and gender-based violence, including allowing courts to make abusers pay for housing damages and moving expenses associated with domestic violence. Cuomo will also propose a domestic violence misdemeanor label to restrict domestic violence abusers' access to guns.
Calls to remove Donald Trump from office continue to intensify, including from Congress member Antonio Delgado, though little actual movement has taken place with Congress having gone home for 2 weeks. Questions continue to mount as to why the Capitol Police failed to protect the Capitol, including why Department of Defense blocked deployment of National Guards from nearby states. A police officer died of his injuries, bringing the death toll to 5, and several officers were seen opening up gates and helping protesters down the stairs.
U.S. employers cut jobs last month for the first time since April, cutting 140,000 positions, highlighting that the economy is faltering as the viral pandemic tightens its grip on consumers and businesses. The unemployment rate stayed at 6.7%, the first time it hasn't fallen since April.
Congressman Sean Maloney of Hudson called for accountability for the president and his enablers and the Republicans who elected to set aside the Electoral College. He stressed that they need to be identified and held accountable. They are either with the American Constitution or not, unquote. Guy, we get a double after all of those headlines today, okay?
They were all worthy.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
Our mission is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's hmm@mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. Up first, in the second half of the two-part interview with HMM correspondent Corinne Carey, Assemblymember and co-host pharmacist John McDonald talks about the distribution of the coronavirus vaccine and what's ahead in terms of the state budget in 2021.
Turning our attention to vaccines, as a pharmacist and co-host, you're going to be on the front lines of making sure that that vaccine gets into arms. What's your assessment of how we've done as a country so far? And when do you think we're going to get to a place where the majority of your neighbors have access to the vaccine?
I don't know if I can speak to the country as a whole. Obviously, New York Times and Wall Street Journal have had articles out the last couple of days about how we've fallen short of the 20 million injection goal that was supposed to be completed by the end of the year. So I'll leave it at that in that regards. I will say this overall, there's a tension and a push and pull going on in regards to the vaccine distribution. The good news is that locally here in the capital region, pharmacists and staff are in nursing homes administering the vaccine to our elders. They are administering it to our first responders, particularly EMS and healthcare professionals that work in these institutional facilities, not the pharmacies per se, but the institutional facilities like the hospitals and the nursing homes are receiving the vaccine. And we are doing pretty well as a state compared to others. However, the challenge is going to be a consistent supply. A consistent supply not to only do the first administration, but to have a backup supply to have in place to do that secondary administration. And that's where this tension continues to grow. You've seen some articles recently by the Times Union about the counties are a little bit perplexed about what's going on. And, you know, the counties are prepared. I talk to them regularly. They will play a very critical role in regards to community immunization through their pods or point of dispensing stations, which will be established in the community, will go to the people, not the people going to it. The pharmacy community is prepared. I got to tell you, I was shocked. I had asked a few times, when is the application going to be ready for pharmacies to start? Because there's a lot of appropriate red tape that we have to go through to protect the chain of supply of product. And it has to be legitimized. And I can tell you this, the State Department of Health has done a very good job of reaching out to the providers. Here's what's happening. Here's what's going on. Here's the applications. We were approved here at the pharmacy probably 4 weeks ago. And we are now getting more regular information that, you know what, here's what you need to keep doing this, need to be thinking about this. How are you going to operate your process? Because it's not as if you're going to walk in and see a line of 25 people in the pharmacy waiting to get a vaccine. That's just not safe for my staff nor my customers who are there. So we have to work on workflow. A lot's going to be done by appointment basis, and then there's going to be community clinic basis. So it is challenging. You know, the governor said this a few times. I think people dismissed it, but we thought the reaction to COVID-19, and Corinne, it's hard to believe, go back to the months of March, April, May, right? We just lost those months, right? We were watching TV, wondering what's going on with our world and the whole nine yards. We thought that was difficult. This is going to be much more difficult because we need to get people not only to show up once, but twice within a prescribed time frame. Pfizer vaccine is 21 days, Moderna is 30 days. If it's one day off here or there, it's not the end of the world, but I've been a pharmacist for 35 years. I have a hard enough time getting people to take their blood pressure medication every day. You know what it's going to be like to get them to come back the second month? I think the good news is we're seeing that this vaccine is being rolled out. It's safe. The adverse reactions, nothing has been out of the norm. Yes, there have been allergic reactions. In some of these situations, they were predictable. But the reality is we're not seeing anything to this date, and this today, the 2nd of January, that is outside the norm of what was expected. So that's going to help build confidence, and we still have a lot of work to do. I spend a lot of time talking to the county legislators in Albany County, particularly Carol McLaughlin and Wanda Willingham. And over in Troy, I've been talking to Mayor Madden about this. We are working on building confidence, particularly in those communities that have never trusted the healthcare system. And that specifically is the Black and Brown community. And we've been having a series of meetings to make sure that the right people are comfortable with the vaccine, but more importantly, the right people are stepping up, they're receiving the vaccine, and they're going to be great ambassadors and disciples of why this vaccine is something people should consider. I think it's important. A person like me, a white male from Cahoes is although I represent this community now for 8 to 10 years, it'll mean something knowing that a pharmacist is doing this and supportive, but it's going to be just as important if they're a preacher or if the director at the local daycare or a nonprofit is also on board, particularly if they're of the same skin color. So it's about building confidence and building faith and trust. And I've been very careful of what I've been saying because I know that people are listening, and I know that there's a lot of doubt. And at the same token, I think as the experience continues to grow, and I see the community at large, people like you and I, being able to receive that vaccine probably, hopefully towards the end of February or March. It all depends on the next two products to come to market. Everyone's focused on Pfizer and Moderna. You won't see Pfizer vaccine coming out of Mara's Pharmacy, more than likely. You might see Moderna, but more than likely you're going to see the AstraZeneca or the Johnson & Johnson product that's coming. That's going to be more stable. It's going to be more appropriate for community pharmacy and clinic use and physician office use. So there's still a lot going on. It's actually, those who like to write about history will have something to write about for the next 30 years, because when we're through this and we've accomplished a goal, we're going to look back and realize that we accomplished some things we never thought could ever happen. The fact that this virus shows up almost a year ago now in another country decimates our economy and the impacts of many people's lives, obviously, many people who lost their lives. But the fact that we were able to bring a vaccine to market that's going to be safe and extraordinarily effective. When you're looking right now, the first two out the door at almost 95% effectiveness on a two-dose regimen, that's remarkable, Corrine. That's almost unheard of. The flu vaccine that we still aggressively promote is usually on a good year 50 to 60% effective. This is remarkable, and it's a reflection that science and the scientists got together, looked at this holistically, were not afraid to use new technologies, particularly with messenger RNA phenomenon that Pfizer and Moderna are using, and we're getting it done. We've got product out there. Now, yes, there's going to be people who are going to look at this, and there's the political conversation about why wasn't this and that. I think you're going to see great progress over the next couple of weeks. I can tell you that Albany Med has been designated as our hub here in the Capital Region. We already had one meeting. We have another meeting scheduled. It's quite regular now. They've already asked for meetings with the pharmacy community, which I'm facilitating. So things are really gearing up. And at the same token, you know what? There's a reason why there's a pace like this. We don't want to overwhelm people too much either. You know, there's going to be a lot of people, like I said earlier, and it bears repeating, that have never trusted the healthcare system for decades, if not generations, and family generations. We don't want them left behind. We want them brought into the fold to have the opportunity, but I am not a proponent of mandating the vaccine. I think if we do this right, we will reach that level that Dr. Fauci and others have talked about to help provide that herd immunity, which is what is really what our goal should be.
People are heralding the end of 2020, a terrible year by anyone's accounting, and welcoming 2021. But as you've hinted at a few times, 2021 could be in some ways even more challenging and more difficult. What are you looking forward to in the new year?
2021 is going to be very interesting. You know, we still have a $175 billion budget to put together. It might be a little bit lower this year. We are uncertain about our financial gaps and how we're going to get there. You know, obviously there's some tax proposals out there, many of which I support, that would help bring revenue and not hurt the middle or low income class. So I think those are issues we have to address. I am very worried about, you know, let's get through this health crisis safely and effectively. And that's where our priority has to be over the next 3 to 6 months. It's going to take some period of time. There's always challenges going on, whether it's environmental, whether it's financial, whether it's housing, all those social determinants of health that I'm very familiar with as the healthcare professional, but also as the legislator, that we continue to have to make work on and make progress on. And it's going to be challenging. It's going to be a little bit different this year, right? We're not going to have the ability, unless something magical happens, for our typical Albany legislative days, right? We're not going to have the busloads of people being bused in from all around the state to lobby and advocate. So, you know, we'll be working in a different format where, unfortunately, everything's going to be probably by Zoom. My office is located in is close to the public. The state capitol is close to the public. So it's going to be a different session. And thank God there's technology out there. I don't know how they did it in 1918. I really don't. It must have been something else back then. But the great thing about being in America is that we can be creative. We can get things done. And we're just going to have to do it.
Well, I really appreciate your time. I know you've got a lot of work to do, so I'm going to let you get back to it. But happy new year, and I'm looking forward to reaching back out to you when news happens and we need your perspective for this radio station.
Anytime. We had a lot of landscape to cover, and I think we got a lot done.
That was Corinne Carey speaking with New York State Assemblyman John McDonald.
Now we go to HMM's Catherine Rafferty with the second part of her conversation with the Albany Birth Justice Storytelling Project. Here's Nakia Tillman, one of the project coordinators.
Being in upstate New York, or being in New York, period, people assume a certain level of education and things that don't necessarily happen. So, when we talk about, racism and people being shocked, like Chloe was, she was upset and mad because you think that in New York, these things wouldn't happen, right? Because we're in New York. But unfortunately, because what racism looks like has changed, nobody's saying the N-word, nobody's calling us, black this and black that. And what it is what it looks like is when you go into a hospital and you complain about how you're being treated, and then you're escorted out, or security comes, or you're told to be quiet, or you're being dismissed and not listened to. This is what causes death. You know what I mean? And a lot of times, if you're not being called that, you kind of brush it off, and you're like, well, maybe it's me. You internalize it, and when you're in that vulnerable state, you don't want to. You want somebody to help you and take care of you, and you're afraid that if you say anything that they will put you out, or they will call security on you because it's been done. And so it and that's what, we want people to know too. It's the little things, it's the nuances of it, and that they can get away with it because they're not clearly stating the N-word. They could say, oh, well, she's doing this, she's disturbing the other patients. And it's like, this woman she's in labor. There's some pain attached to that, Or why shouldn't she ask for this or that when everybody, when white women can ask for this and she's treated a certain way, but when I ask for it, it's like, how dare you? And so, that's when we talk about, when we say it's not so much as when you can see it, the language that's changing, and we know it when we feel it. When somebody has offended you because you're like, wait a minute, But if you speak up, there could be consequences. So that would be, if you take anything away from this, it's understanding that it's changing, and a lot of it has to do with the language at this point. And that's what structural racism looks like.
Right. And it's like you're saying, it's not so much this overt racism anymore. It's this subvert racism that's in microaggressions and smaller interactions and the way things are talked about. So back to the project, what were some of the initial research questions that you were trying to answer with this study, and what potential answers or solutions to these issues might have come from the project?
So our research questions were, how do Black birthing peoples in Albany County experience pregnancy, birth, and the postpartum period? What are the needs and assets of local communities impacted by racial disparities in birth and maternal outcomes? And in what ways can we organize to build supportive, cohesive communities around birthing peoples?
Do you feel like you answered those questions, or did you find any solutions to those questions?
We didn't finish the project. It's an unfinished project, basically, and we're still working on it. We had planned a community event, but given the fact that we weren't able to do the community event, which was scheduled for April 25th, right as the pandemic was, we were in initial lockdown at that moment. We're still trying to figure out like what our next steps are. But in the summer, we did start looking at some of these stories that we collected, and there were lots of themes. And we also had one meeting in March 7th, which was amazing that we were able to have that meeting just before everything got locked down. And that was with the storytellers and the listeners and everybody in the project, and where we could all listen to the stories together. The themes in the stories, and anyone else can help me out, but a lot of the things that Nakia was saying around barriers to breastfeeding. I mean, we have lots of stories around that. We have, this separation of the mom and the child, not keeping that dyad together is just, was something that, is so striking, because you hear that in so many stories, the mom saying they took my baby away and I had to ask, why are you taking it to the NICU? And, trying to find answers to questions that they should have been informed about, right? But you also hear on the positive side, and there are many stories that of the traumatic side, but on the positive side, you hear a lot about family members just coming in, really supporting, demanding a room when, mom is being told they should go back home, and saying, no, we're staying, you have the space, give us, a place to labor, we're ready. And other ways advocating for their, their loved one, if it's their daughter or whoever. But also, stories where, people were told, I really want to ask my mom to come, to come support me. And, nurses or whoever saying, no, you can't do that. It's pretty horrifying, actually, how pervasive and it almost every step of the way, right? People have to advocate for themselves when they're in this vulnerable situation, as Nakia said, where really you should just be totally encircled with love and care, right? That's the way it should happen. And it could be like that. And I think that's the strength of what BirthNet and others are doing, is trying to counter this sort of very medicalized approach. We as a community can take steps, and we will take steps to provide supports.
One of the things that was consistent in a lot of our stories were that the moms were being ignored in their requests for certain procedures, or in their requests for medicine, or they were not being consulted before, getting an epidural, or not being consulted before C-sections, not being consulted before episiotomy. It's just ultimately not being listened to and having their needs being ignored was unfortunately a very consistent theme in the project. So I do think that's something that's worth mentioning when we talk about the Black maternal health crisis, is Black women are just literally not being listened to when they're more than aware of what their needs are in that situation.
It's good that you guys are all providing this platform for Black women to be listened to too. Now, even though it's after the fact, but it's really important that their voices are heard in this, right? So what do you each hope that the general public might take away from this, when they are eventually able to hear these stories? Or is that...
Yeah, what we do with BirthNet is we were able to get permission for some of the moms for some of our projects. So if we do a Facebook Live or a Zoom link meeting, we'll showcase one of the moms or some of the moms, just to, make it real for the listeners to say, hey, she was saying, you probably think you're the only one going through this. And it's like, no, chances are somebody else is experiencing this too. So we're trying to use the stories that way to showcase moms and you know, that way and support the story. Because the birth justice stories, I thought it was amazing. And I think, you know, we can continue to do them. They're definitely worth doing.
For any mother that may hear this, the power of like, no, the power of saying no, like, I know what's wrong with my body. I know what I feel. I know where I am. I know I am conscious. I know that I'm intelligent enough to know what I want. The power of this kind of holding that power and kind of practicing that power of saying, listen, I know what I want. And not thinking that you only have one choice, because there's never only one choice, the way of giving birth. And you know how you feel. So I want all mothers to literally feel empowered and opening their mouth and saying, listen, this is what I want, and I'm not going to stop until I get it. And for mothers to know that they're definitely, definitely not alone, no matter the age, no matter like where you are, what state, no matter where it is happening, no matter how educated you think your doctor is, there's always some underlying factor, and you're definitely not alone in wanting help and needing help. And don't feel muted like I said I did, and trying to share your story and reaching out for help.
I think it's important to me that the general population hears this, because Nikki had touched on it earlier, but a lot of times when we think of racism and we think of white supremacy, we think about like being called the N-word, but oftentimes we don't think about it in its relationship to medicine. We don't think about the quantity of Black women who are being who are dying disproportionately in childbirth, who are experiencing C-sections disproportionately compared to other birthing peoples, who are more likely to have like stillborn and preterm births and stuff like that. We don't think about it that way, because I think our society perceives doctors and medicine as being like absolute, and we don't really get the platform to be able to question medicine, especially as it pertains to giving birth. You know, Black women are experiencing the multiple overlapping oppressions of like being Black and also being woman and all the things that come with that. And I think it's important that society is aware that this is happening, because a lot of times it gets pushed under the rug. You know, we have been conditioned to perceive birth as this very dangerous and very life-threatening process, and it doesn't have to be, especially not when it comes to Black and brown people, who the disparity is consistent across socioeconomic status and income and education, and these things are consistent.
That was HMM's Catherine Rafferty speaking with Nikia Tillman, one of the coordinators of the Albany Birth Justice Storytelling Project.
Thanks, Guy. For those of you just tuning in, I'm still Lavonia Mallory.
And I remain Guy Schaefer. And you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community. And it's supported by independent donations. Thank you all, and to our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. You can hear all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org. Up next, Naomi Edmonds, a Black queer deaf guide and author of The Glorious Hug Home Blog, talks to HMM correspondent Corinne Carey about death, dying, and the importance of end-of-life care options that respect the dying and allow for peace and dignity.
Naomi, thank you so much for taking some time to talk to me today.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
It's interesting, maybe for our listeners, to find out how I encountered you in the very darkest of all of the days during the pandemic in the spring, when so many New Yorkers were losing their lives. Mm-hmm. I encountered a webinar I think will always stay with me. It was called Saying It Louder, How to Have a Good Death in a Racist Society. I think that was the subtitle of the event. Mm-hmm. And it was a conversation with a number of Black women, some of them doulas, death doulas, about what dying is like in a racist society, and their emotions and feelings around that. And I felt very privileged to be witness to that conversation. And since then, I've reached out to that organization to find out if there were, you know, New York partners of that organization here. And I found you, and I'm so grateful for that.
I'm so glad you found me as well. That webinar was such a relief and a joy to do, because it just really felt like we were speaking to things that we, as you know, doulas of color and Black doulas, have been talking about amongst ourselves for a while. So it just felt really good to get that out into a space where it was accessible and could really become a conversation.
So you are affiliated with the organization that put on that webinar. Can you tell us about how you got involved in this work and your affiliation with the group?
I got involved in this work a little over a year ago, and I was grieving the loss of a mother figure who was very close to me, my partner at the time. Her mother had passed from cervical cancer. Some time had gone by, and I remember just thinking, as I was there supporting my partner at the time, I was also supporting her mother, and I was just thinking about how lucky I felt and how beautiful it was to be able to just sit with her and be with her as she was in that transitional space of dying and kind of just saying goodbye to this life that she had been living. And it was so moving and kind of earth-shattering for me to just listen to her talk about things she was afraid of, like, you know, just her fear of dying young, and the things she felt like she wouldn't see, and just kind of being there for that process as she went through that. And I just remember thinking, like, she was so lucky to have this really big family that just wanted to be there for her and just, like, wanted to meet her there. And, you know, sometimes it was really hard for them to sit with the things that she was telling them, but she was just so lucky to have them. And I just remember thinking that I wish that more people had that kind of support, especially here in New York, where there are so many people who die and their deaths go completely unacknowledged because there's nobody to witness it. There's nobody to be at their side to ease them out of the world the way that, you know, they were eased into the world. And that just seemed like a real shame to me. So I did some research and I started thinking about volunteering for hospice care and palliative care. So I started training to volunteer for that. And at the same time, I also came across death doulas and end-of-life guides. And I loved the idea of just like a non-medical person that provides holistic, spiritual, mental support for people who are transitioning and their communities, their pods that are holding them through that as well. So that is how I came across Going with Grace and their training program. And the wonderful Elua Arthur, like, I can't say more kind words about her. I think her work is amazing, amazing, amazing. And so I took her training program, and just as I took it, like, all the light bulbs just started going off. This feels right. Teaching people how to support those who are dying feels right. And it's interesting because it's not necessarily something that needs to be taught, but I think in this day and age that we're in, it's something that does need to be supported with, like, a grounding of knowledge. And I found that really helpful. And then shortly after I finished her wonderful training program, I lost my mother. And that was, I don't really have words to describe how lucky I felt to have had that training at that time, but also just how devastating it was to kind of have to get this, like, hands-on knowledge in a way. Mm. So that's kind of how my journey began. My journey as a death guide is kind of dovetailed with my own grief journey, and that's been a very interesting experience for sure.
I'm speaking with Naomi Edmondson, who is a queer radical death guide for the Hudson Mohawk magazine. Can you give our listeners a bit more description of what a death doula is? I love when you said easing people out of this life the way that they were eased into this life. What is a death doula?
A death doula is somebody who provides non-medical holistic support the dying person and their community and their pod through the dying process. A death guide, a death doula can really come at any point of the journey. They can assist people in figuring out paperwork, like prior to dying. Like if you're young, healthy, or older, healthy, wherever you might be in the journey, and you just think, I want to start the process of just like preparing myself and preparing my family and preparing my house and just all of those things, like a death guide can help you sort those things out. And then when it comes to the dying process, a death guide can be somebody who offers emotional support to the person who's passing, emotional support to their pod. They can help with running errands. They can help with respite care when the family might need just some breathing room to just step back and care for themselves, because caregiver burnout can be very real. They can sit vigil. They can also help with legacy projects that the dying person might want to leave behind to their families. And that can look like a plethora of things. It can look like, you know, creating songs, writing down like recipes, and it can look like a photo album. It can look so many different ways. And then once the dying process has been completed and the person has passed, a death guide can be really helpful in helping the family plan the service, whether that be something in person or helping with the Zoom memorial, helping to create rituals to honor the life of the person that has passed. It can just look so many ways, but the grounding part of it is that a death guide is somebody who is there to support and to meet both the person dying and their family in that space, in a space where it can be hard for a lot of other people to meet you and sit with you. I've heard this other places, but I love the idea that a death doula or a death guide isn't meant to kind of just like write you to death and be like, this is how you do it, let me tell you how to do it, but it really is somebody to walk alongside you as you figure things out for yourself.
It's hard to have a discussion like this without acknowledging the disproportionate impact that COVID has had on people of color and Black Americans in particular. But it's not new. Death itself has had a disparate impact on our Black and brown brothers and sisters. And I just wonder if you could comment on how important it is to have care options, particularly end-of-life care options, that are sensitive to the needs of people of color.
I don't have enough words to describe how important it is to have end-of-life care options that are particular to the needs of Black and brown communities. It's just so important on a vital level to have people who look like you and who understand what your community is and understand the needs of community to be present at the end of life, because it can already be such a fraught time, especially for Black and brown communities, because medical racism, police brutality, we're dealing with just so much on so many fronts that at the end of life, when somebody is dying or has died, and we're talking about like a funeral service or just some kind of service to memorialize them, having adequate, more than adequate care at the end of life can really be the difference between a person feeling like they're dying, but dying with dignity and dying with honor and dying from a place of being seen, really seen and acknowledged, and a family having time to honor them and feeling like they are also being honored. That can really be the difference between a good death, a death that feels like it belongs to that person, and a death that, you know, could be anybody's, that is nonspecific, that where there is no care and there is really like no peace when you think about it. And Black and brown communities are so deserving of that, so deserving of having peace at the end of life.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Oh, thank you for having me.
That was Naomi Edmondson, a Black queer death guide, author of the Glorious Home blog, a conversation with HMM correspondent Corinne Carey. That was a good piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Up next, HMM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs spoke with Keandre Harrison. Keandre Harrison is a singer/actor from Kimball, West Virginia. Erica and Keandre met in Orlando, Florida, where he attended the Arts Orlando International Showcase.
This is HMM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs for the Media Sanctuary, and today I am in Orlando, Florida at the Arts International Showcase. Today I am speaking with Keandre Harrison. He is an actor and a singer. How are you doing today, Keandre?
I'm fine, Erica. How about you?
I'm very good. Thank you for coming on the show.
You're welcome.
You are a part of the family now.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so let's get started. What city are you from, and what city did you audition?
Well, I'm from...
And what was your audition like? What did you perform, and how'd it go?
Well, I performed You Deserve It by Anthony Brown, and good I'm here, so I'm guessing it was good.
How did you get knowledge of the arts?
Well, I was scrolling on Facebook one day, and then, like, in the middle of nowhere, it just popped up.
Yeah?
How that was going different places. I signed myself up.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What was your mother's thoughts? Because you are 17 years of age, right?
And she said she was iffy about it at first, but she was just going on along with it, and that's how we got here today.
Right, as every parent should. Okay. Why was your mother iffy about the situation of you coming to the arts to perform?
Because she knew the amount of money she had to pay, and she knew that it could possibly be a scam.
Okay. Alright. Why do you enjoy acting and singing?
Well, it's a relief, you know. When you go out there and act, it's something you like to do. Just like for somebody who plays football or basketball, they put their heart into it. It can ease their pain, their anger. Same way with acting and being on stage, it helps me as well. And so, also, this has always been my dream to do so and have a career in acting and singing for others.
Okay, and how did you begin singing?
Well, I was a little kid. I'm a church boy. I was raised in church.
Okay, and, hallelujah, praise the Lord.
All right. I would watch other people sing, like the choir in my church and sing, and that just encouraged me to get up and start, you know, start singing and get out there. I'm not all the way there yet, but that's why I'm here and I'm working on it.
That's right. Always training and practicing. Initially, what were your first thoughts when you got the email saying, "Welcome to the arts"?
Well, it was 12 o'clock in the morning, 12:07 to be exact. And I opened my email because they informed us that we would be getting the email if we made it in. Ran straight downstairs to the mom. My mom was in bed. And I said, "Look, Mom, I made it to the arts." But there was more excitement. And then my mom made it, which was a good reaction. It was exciting and pretty joy.
So would you say your mom is leery on you becoming an actor or a singer? What are her thoughts on your passion?
She's just there to be by my side. She supports. She's ready for me to get out there. And I think this is something she personally wants me to do too, to be honest.
Everybody wants their baby to be a star.
Yeah, so I think she feels pretty good and confident about it, just as I do.
How do you feel you perform? If you could go back and change anything, what would it be?
I mean, I performed decent. I could have done way better. If I could go back and, you know, re-perform, I would fix my nervousness and my quivering when I get nervous, my shaking, and try my best not show that I'm nervous when I am nervous. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
What songs did you perform?
More Than Anything, that's it. But my monologue was from Lion King, and I was screaming both of them, so.
Okay, well, we're happy you dove into it. You know, yeah. That's the first step. You know, there's so many shy kids out there that are still quivering in their boots, wanting to act, sing, dance, and they're just scared. And they're scared of rejection, they're scared of the laughter or the failure, yes. And
that's
you're already
causes.
Doing it.
Yeah.
So congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Do you have any experience within the industry prior to being at the
Drama Club events? I would, you know, get up and perform in the Drama Club events for like Christmas, play festivals and all that, be MC at our school.
Oh,
and,
yeah?
Just try to be bold and show them that, you know, I'm on my way up to the top.
You're that person.
Yes, yes.
What was it like MCing for your school? That sounds like really hard, but fun at the same
time.
Yeah,
very fun. It was really hard, but it was very fun because people at my school think I'm a comedian. And,
oh, do they know?
I'm a class clown.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so.
Well, you need to make me laugh.
Okay.
What are some of your goals for this week? What are you expecting, and how are you going to accomplish them?
Well, my main goal is to, you know, not walk out of here without something. You know, that's everyone's thought when they first come to the arts. You want to be here. You don't want to leave without, you know, taking anything home. So my goal is not to leave here without bringing anything home. So that way, if I was to get well known, or, you know, which is not all about being well known, you know, because I'm not all for money. I'm also for like getting myself out there to help others, you know.
Of course.
So just so I can like pay back to my mom and those who, you know, raised me since I was a kid and stuff like that.
Amen. I'm a firm believer.
Yes.
One day I'm gonna buy my mom a big house. How you doing, Mary?
The world.
So tell me, what have you learned about yourself here? You said that if you could go back in your performances, you would change, you know, your nervousness, your jitterbug, you know, your jittering, your teetering.
I've learned that despite my nervousness, I really didn't let it overcome me, because even though I was nervous, I still popped out the nervous box and I kept going. Out of my nervousness, it didn't stop. I showed them that I still am the guy even though I was nervous. So not only that, I just realized that you have to be very brave and courageous to go in front of people who can literally say, well, we want you, we want to make you well known, or we want you to be on our team. Or if they don't want you to be on our team, you know, that's very heartbreaking. So, yeah, just.
So, do you have any tips for people who are interested in acting, dancing, singing, or, you know, just actually just trying to come out their shell a little bit more? Talk to me. What are your thoughts?
I say despite the negativity or the negativity that you're thinking, you know, go beyond that, you know, just go straight for it. I've learned this week through the arts that no matter how you may feel bad-wise, negatively-wise, just don't show it, you know, just shoot your shot, know you did your best, and have confidence. That's what's going to get you, you know, where you want to be. Confidence and faith is key in a situation like this.
Do you think sometimes we might screw ourselves out of a situation because of the way we are reacting or coming off to someone?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. And like, also, you know, you have to watch what you say when you're trying to do stuff like that, because, you know,
ears everywhere, eyes everywhere.
Yeah, it could be an agent. You don't know, you said something and lost your chance. So
definitely. Okay, so do you have anything that we should be looking forward to seeing soon? How can people get in touch with you? Where can we see you at? What's the next thing for you?
I have two people looking at me to, you know, look deep down into my singing. And
oh, is that right?
Interested in my singing.
Okay.
Yeah, so hopefully, you know, you'll know me by singing, you know, and maybe acting, because I do want to act for right now. But for right now, I'm focused on singing, and acting will be coming later on down the road.
Okay, and what is the genre you want to sing for?
Gospel and maybe some R&B, because I can sing R&B too.
Why would you prefer gospel?
Because that's what has got me through my breakdowns and like, and helped me come through a breakthrough, you know.
Definitely. Amen. Okay, so do you have any final words?
No, just be encouraged.
Okay. Well, you did not give us your Instagram handle, so I'm going to need that. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, drop them for me. Come on.
My Facebook is Keandre Harrison. I don't have Twitter. And my Instagram is... My Facebook is Keandre Harrison. And my Instagram is KKeeperReal_.
No, start over, because I don't want that in the video. So start over.
My Facebook is Keandre Harrison. And my Instagram is KKeeperReal_101415.
Okay. Well, listen, folks, this man's going to be a star. And I'm so happy and honored that I had the pleasure of interviewing you first. Mm-hmm. And I can't wait to see you make it, because I definitely see you doing big things, honey.
Thank you, honey.
Thank you. I'm honored to sit here with you. And this has been HMO correspondent Erica Diggs for the Hudson Mohawk Radio. And I spoke with Keandre Harrison. He is a 17-year-old boy from Kimball, West Virginia, and he is here at the arts to perform and show who he really is and what he can do. Yes. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was HMM Erica Diggs speaking with singer and actor Keandre Harrison. Good piece.
Yeah. All right, and now to close out the show, we're going to turn the mic around and speak with our engineer and the coordinator of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Alexis Goldsmith. Alexis, welcome to this side of the show.
Hey, thanks for letting me speak. But I will say I'm not technically the coordinator anymore, but I was the coordinator for 2 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Thank you for the clarification. So how did you become the coordinator for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine?
I started as an intern at the Sanctuary as a radio intern, and I just started taking on more and more responsibilities for the show, and just got really interested, and eventually they hired me as the coordinator. that's basically how it happened.
What got you what was interesting? What was appealing about the work?
I was really interested because I had never seen this model of reporting before, where there were community members doing their own reporting and telling their own stories, and it was getting on the radio and on the internet. And I thought at that moment where the press was so under attack that this was a really unique option to keep this democratic institution of the press alive.
Awesome. Yeah, that's great. I mean, the feeling is mutual. Can you talk a little bit about the kinds of behind the scenes work that it takes to bring our listeners their local news at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. every weekday?
Yeah. For those that don't know, the Hudson Mohawk Magazine airs live every weekday. It's from 6 to 7, and we have an hour's worth of original content. And behind the scenes, as the coordinator, I just finalize the calendar, make sure that we have all the content that we need for today, checking with the hosts, make sure they're ready, make sure the script gets written. I train interns how to engineer, how to post the social media and the podcasts. I train people how to use Audacity, how to use SoundCloud, how to mic an interview. How to conduct an interview. I've given workshops on reporting, and it's been a lot of learning as you go, and just meeting people where they're at with their technical abilities, with what stories they want to tell, and just helping assist them in doing what they want to do with it.
Right.
You sort of modestly said that you are the coordinator or the ex-coordinator or the previous coordinator. I mean, in reality, you know, weren't you really like during this COVID pandemic holding the sanctuary down?
Mm-hmm. Sort of. Yeah, the building's been closed since March because it's not really, we don't have the type of air filtration system you need to be safe to have it open. So unfortunately, we closed the studio as well. The studio is especially unsafe because it's small and airtight. So we haven't had hosts in the studio. We're doing it over Zoom now. But yes, I've been engineering every day, and I'm basically the only person in the building every day. I see people on Zoom, but yeah, it's just me in the studio.
And thank you for highlighting that, Livonia, because I really do want to emphasize that Alexis has done like a heck of a lot of work to keep the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on air. And I feel so grateful to have Alexis really like holding down the fort there.
Thanks, you guys. It's mutual.
And Alexis, you know, I'm going to ask you a loaded question. Tell me, who are your favorite hosts?
And why is it us?
On Friday.
I love all of the hosts.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
Yeah, that's a political answer.
We have some hosts that are very dedicated to the show, and you two are some of the most dedicated and most consistent hosts that we have. Andrea and Mark, also some of the most consistent hosts. And those hosts that stick with it and do it every week start to develop a rapport with each other. And the vibe on Fridays and on those days when we have the same hosts is a lot more fun. And I really appreciate that you guys make it fun.
So what's next for you?
I have just been hired as the National Organizing Director for Beyond Plastics, which is based out of Bennington College, but I still live on the block, and I'm supporting the transition to the new HMM coordinator, and I'm still helping behind the scenes at the sanctuary with a lot. So it's kind of like I'm totally still here. I'm just not the official coordinator anymore.
I'm glad we'll still have you around.
Yeah.
So when you think about transitioning to your new job and congratulations on that, getting that new position, I know you're going to do an extraordinary job there as well. When you think about transitioning over, what's the one thing that you want to, if you could take one thing with you, one memory, what is your greatest memory of your time here at the sanctuary?
Oh, there's been so many, but I really miss the building being open and having events here, and how many people pack into this space for events. And I've loved doing the show while events are going on and seeing these things happen simultaneously. Right. And I also really just admire the consistency of the show. I mean, when we say we're live every weekday from 6 to 7, we are live every weekday from 6 to 7 with an hour of original content. And the amount of people power it takes to get that done is just astounding. And I've become an expert in our community because of this show. So I appreciate that, too.
You already talked about it a little bit, but can you say a little bit more about why local media is so important, especially at this historical moment?
Yeah, well, those out there should know that the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is the only program of its kind in this country. It's the only hour-long grassroots radio news program that I know of that's doing this work. And I would like to see more radio stations doing this kind of thing, but local and especially independent media like what we do is so important because it's being told by the people who live in this community and who are living these stories. You know the old saying that if a tree falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, if an injustice happens in our community, or if advocates are out there doing hard work to make real social change, but there's no media there to witness it, those events are less likely to have an impact. And what HMM has done is keep a consistent record of what's happening in our community. And we're doing some of the most in-depth and nuanced reporting of issues in the Capital Region, and in Troy in particular. And that record has a cumulative effect. For example, on the issue of the Norlite incinerator, HMM was reporting on Norlite long before the AFFF issue exploded. And that reporting that we did didn't get a lot of attention, but when the AFFF issue made Norlite famous, that record was there for people who became interested. And suddenly, reporters for national publications like The Intercept were reaching out to us about Norlite. And the people and interns who do this work become experts on what's going on. If you listen to HMM, you start to understand how deeply interconnected these issues are. And anyone is welcome to come and do this work, regardless of their experience or abilities. Like, no one is left out.
What kind of advice would you give anyone who wants to bring local media to their community?
I would say local media needs your help to tell this story. There are some technical aspects involved, but you don't have to get super techie about it. And the Sanctuary would love to help you get started if you want to start your own program, or if you want to do reporting for Hudson Mohawk Magazine, especially if you're in our region. The press is under enormous strain because of attacks on media outlets and the sheer amount of work that it takes, the amount of people power that it takes. And whatever you're doing, whether it's organizing or hobbies or your career, it's part of the story of social and environmental justice. So don't be afraid that maybe you don't feel qualified or don't feel like anyone will listen, because this work is essential to democracy and it has a direct effect on your life and your community. The freedom of the press is enshrined in the First Amendment of the Constitution. And in fact, journalism is the only occupation that's expressly protected by the First Amendment. So if you're out there listening and you want to help tell the story, please consider becoming a producer for this program. Like, that's my advice. It's really easy to get started and you will get a lot of support. And you can also intern for the Sanctuary for college credit if you want to get even more involved. And shameless plug, the best way to get started is to email info@mediasanctuary.org.
All right.
Thank you. That's such beautiful advice, Alexis. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for asking me.
And guys, guess what?
Is it that time again, Livonia?
That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, and our engineer tonight and the former coordinator of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine is Alexis Goldsmith. You can tune back in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news. And you can find all of the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org and on our Facebook page at facebook.com/WOC105.3 FM.
This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute, local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call us at 518-272-2390. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.